Okay. If I remember correctly, we kind of ended the discussion, getting towards the end of last week, and we talked about Ahithophel's suicide. Remember Ahithophel, one of the advisors of Absalom, a trusted advisor and confidant and friend of David. But Ahithophel, as things played out, Ahithophel realized that things were not going his way. He had put a lot of his family that he was concerned about in danger. He went back to his hometown, the village in which he came from, which is very close, just to the west of Hebron, and took his own life and committed suicide. And at that point in time, there seems to be a gap in time, because as we've seen, in many cases in the Bible, you will find that one verse and the next verse, it's not like a day, the next day something happened. There is a period of time now that transpires that we don't know how long, because it took Absalom now is following Hushai's advice, that is to gather a really big army. Remember, his advice was to gather an army from Dan to Beersheba. And that was pretty much the entire United Kingdom that David had put together. So he was raising this army. He's put together an army of about 40,000 troops. And he then marches this army, if you will. He moves his army then out of Jerusalem, where he is now sitting, and David has moved off over in this area over in here. Absalom moves his army across the River Jordan, around in this general area right here, just to the west of Gilgal, and then moves up and camps in the area of Gilead. And he's kind of, I guess, he's still waiting in there. Maybe some of the troops are joining them, and they're getting their supplies and everything ready to go. And while he's as this was going on, he appoints a new army commander. His overall army commander now is a fellow named Amasa, or Amasa, I'm not sure which one it is, but this gentleman was kind of a surprising pick, and I find it really interesting. It said that he picked Amasa instead of Joab. Now, Joab has been the longtime commander of David's army. He's been apparently very loyal to David, but at the same time, who was the one who tried to pull the wool over David's eyes to get Absalom back from his exile? It was Joab, wasn't it? So you wonder if Absalom would have asked Joab, said, "Would you be my commander in chief?" He might have said yes. But we're going to see that Joab apparently pretty fluid, because the next time we see his name, he's accepting a command. He's being appointed a commander of David's army again. So anyway, Amasa is selected. Now, this, like all of them, they seem to be a family connection. You know, their daddies were brothers or some to that effect. So if you look through the lineage of Amasa, he's kin to Absalom in some way, and I've forgotten. I saw one of the writers had tracked it through and come up with the exact relationship. But if you think about this, I don't know, if you consider David and his household with all the wives and concubines and all the daughters and sons that he had, and then they had children, if all the families of influence like that in the kingdom had multiple, you know, large families, then almost all had to be kin to each other somehow. Kind of reminds me of the Bethel Church of Christ about 10 years ago when we came here. We finally decided if you wasn't a Pepper or a Peppers, you weren't a part of the charter group. So like that, in Jerusalem and in the kingdom there, I don't see how they all weren't kin to each other. But the reality was that they were. This appears to have been more of a, as we'll see later, this may very well have been a political appointment to appease the people and some of the leaders in Hebron and where Amasa was from. Because remember, where was Absalom first appointed king? In Hebron, wasn't he? And they jumped on the bandwagon. The folks in Judah jumped on that bandwagon and was supporting of Absalom. So that might have very well have been a political as well as a family tie appointment to Amasa. Now the key to this thing was that Amasa had absolutely zero experience, and the Bible talks about him being incompetent as a military commander. So have we seen incompetent people appointed to key positions in our own government? We have, haven't we? Because of loyalties, because of what they had done and had been good at, but turned out to be not good at whatever else. So we see that today. So now then we've got this army of king, as Absalom is calling himself king now, moving in and camping and bivouacking in the area of Gilead. Now David has moved his headquarters, so to speak, into the city of Mahanaim, and he's kind of collecting his forces there. As he gets there, he's visited by some well-known people. The first person that the Bible talks about being there is Shobi, S-H-O-B-I, Shobi. He is the son of the Ammonite king. Now remember, several weeks ago we talked about David and when he marched against the city of Ramoth, which is was the capital of the Ammonite kingdom. He took that territory, took that kingdom, finally laid siege to the city and took it. But Shobi was the son of that king at that time. And apparently David had shown him some kindness, had set him up as like a puppet ruler, I guess, of that area, and had treated him very well. So Shobi comes to David and he brings supplies and food and so forth, as does a gentleman named Machir. Now Machir comes from the city of Lodibar. Let's see if we look at the map, Lodibar is up in the northern part of the kingdom up there. This is the same guy. Well, first off, he turned out he was the brother of Bathsheba. I'm telling you, they were all kin to each other. But anyway, he was Bathsheba's brother. He was also the man who gave sanctuary to Saul's grandson and Jonathan's son, Mephibosheth. So this is the same guy who did it. And then also a guy named Barzillai, who was from Gilead. And that's the area where, that's the same area where Absalom is now camped out there, waiting to put the rest of his army together and move on towards facing David. Now, all of these men were influential. Some of the writers that I read talked about them being princes. I don't think they were royal a royal prince, but they were very influential within the nation of Israel there. And they brought a lot of food and supplies and so forth into David. There's no mention of it, but you'd almost think that by bringing in the supplies and so forth, that they may very well have brought some troops and men fighting men, but we don't know that because we'll see later that as David puts his army together, he's going to be pretty well outnumbered when he goes up against Absalom. So with these men showing up, that's got to be a boost to David in terms of people that are supporting. He finds support. Remember, Rabbath, where Shomi comes from, is down to the southwest. The guy from Lodibar is the northern part of the kingdom, and Gilead, they're kind of in the middle. So David is now seeing support from the people across the kingdom, not just seeing the support for Absalom coming out of the south and the southeastern or western part of his kingdom. So that's got to be a morale boost for David, making him feel better that people actually are supporting him. And as those men visit, bring his supplies and so forth in, we end that chapter and we'll move into chapter 18. Now chapter 18, we will be looking at the fact that Absalom's army is defeated, disastrously defeated by a much smaller army, and Absalom's death itself. In chapter 18 here, as we go forward, we're going to be looking at the fact that the first thing we'll consider is that David will actually now sit down, organize his army, the fighting men that he has, and then set a chain of command in place, if you will. We'll look at how that army then attacks and pretty much slaughters Absalom's army. We'll look at spend some time with Absalom's death. Now that the fighting is ended, Absalom is buried. Then the news of that victory gets sent to David, and his response when he gets that news. In the early part of the chapter here, we're looking at David. David, it says that he musters his army and this kind of thing. Basically, he's trying to determine how many fighting men he has at his command to go against Absalom and his army. Based on the fact that we looked at the last couple of 3 weeks, the fact that David had a pretty good spy network set up between the court, the royal court in Jerusalem, and to him, my guess is that he has a pretty good idea of what Absalom's bringing up against him in terms of size of force and so forth. So he puts his army, he says, okay, we don't have quite as many. But he takes his army and splits it into three divisions today, three groups, three battle groups today. And he names Joab as the commander of one of them, Abishai, Joab's brother, the commander of the other one, and another one was Ittai the Gittite. Now we have to go back to a few weeks ago when David was at the brook of Hebron and all the people were passing by and he was seeing who was going to leave town with him, basically. And Ittai was not a Jew. He was not part of the nation, but he had come to live in Jerusalem and be a part of that, and he had a pretty large company with him. He also was rather well known as a good military commander. So David appoints him as the commander of the third division of his army. Now I think from some of the reading, one of the Josephus accounts, I think, numbers David's army somewhere in the neighborhood of about 4,000 people, so 4,000 fighting men. So we got 4,000 over here fighting for David and 40,000 for Absalom. Now that sounds like that ought to be a no-brainer of who's going to win that battle, doesn't it? If we look at the 40,000, though, unfortunately they are being led by a very egotistical king who thinks he's going to be glorious in this battle. He's on his royal mule and he's out leading this thing. Remember Hushai's picture image that he painted for Absalom when he was giving him this advice. He played to his ego, made him sound like he was just going to be victorious and glorious and all the things that played to Absalom. Now, in his commander-in-chief, Amasa is totally incompetent. So now then we got a lot of numbers over here led by vain, incompetent people, and we got a smaller force of 4,000 broken into three divisions, and all of these people, these three commanders, Joab, Abishai, and Ittai, were all experienced commanders, plus David is a pretty battle-worn veteran of the wars that he's fought, and very knowledgeable of fighting in that time. So we've got some good things going for David's army, just overshadowed by the sheer numbers. when David sets all this in place, and it talks about giving Joab, Abishai, and Ittai command of these three divisions, but he also said he sets sub-commanders, and you know, so basically he's put in an organization structure of overall command and unit command, small unit commanders and this kind of stuff. So he's got his army in place now, structured like he wants it to go to battle. And then he tells his commanders, I think he's talking to his commanders, the text says the people, but I think my personal assessment is he's talking to these commanders. But at the same time, regardless, he tells these, whoever he's talking to here, I want to lead my army. This is like David. David has always led, hadn't he? With the exception of a couple of times which turned out to be disastrous for him. When it came, so in this case, he says, you know, he wants to lead this attack. He wants to go into the field of battle with his army. And the men, and I think the text says the men or the people, I forget, but again, I believe it was those commanders that convinced David, you don't need to be in the field of battle. He said they could kill a thousand or 10,000 of us, and it wouldn't matter. Wouldn't kill 10,000 because they didn't have before, did they? But you could kill a lot of us, and it wouldn't matter as much as it would if they find you on the field of battle and kill you. So they convinced David then to stay in the city there where he is somewhat safer. But they couch it this way: you stay in the city, and you will know if things go bad for us, then you will know to send the reserve force or reinforcements to help us out, which is not an unknown strategy in today's battles. There's usually a reserve force somewhere, so that as a battle plan lays out, if there's a weakness spotted and the need be, a reserve force can be moved in. So they make the king feel like, hey, you're not just hiding out for your own safety, which you need to because you're more valuable than the rest of us. But at the same time, you're going to be an actual part of this thing because you'll know, you'll have the knowledge and so forth to send reinforcements if we're needed. David agrees to that. But I think David had an ulterior motive in wanting to lead the army. He wanted to be in the battlefield for another reason. And why do you think that might be? Absolutely. To protect Absalom. So his commanders now have convinced him he needs to stay in the city and be ready to send reserves if needed or the reinforcements to somewhere that might be needed. But then he said, okay, and if we can kind of look at his mind, we're seeing, okay, if I can't be on the battlefield, I'm going to give some orders here. And he gives some orders that are very specific to Absalom. And the text and the verse says, and this was his order, deal gently for my sake with the young man Absalom. Deal gently. What would you interpret that to mean? Don't kill him. Don't kill him. Now, when two opposing armies face each other, what's the primary objective of one soldier to another soldier? I have to kill one of them's got to die, hadn't it, unfortunately. Somebody is going to die. But David puts a standing order to his three commanders. And if you read it, you'd get the feeling that he probably gave that order to all his sub-commanders and all of this, because the text goes on to say that all the people knew the order, and all the people heard when the king gave the captain's orders concerning Absalom. So apparently everybody in that army knew of this command, whether David had told them personally or whether they had just heard it. But the word was, deal gently with my son, or for my sake. Now, some of you have been in the military and have made those kind of decisions. When the king gives orders to do this in the face of an upcoming battle, what would that do to the commanders? And I'll tell you, this one was kind of personal to me, because the first thing I thought of was that my generation's war was in Southeast Asia. And Washington tried to run that war. If you read a little of the history of it, Washington tried, the presidents of this country, or at least two of them, tried to run the war and hamstring the military commander. So that's the kind of thing, yeah, in terms of rules of engagement, in terms of targeting, in terms of timing. If you read a little back through the Vietnam era history, you'll see that that was the case. And a lot of, I'll have to admit, as I look around the room, a lot of you should remember some of that. Some of you won't, I understand. But at the same time, that's what struck me. Here's King David sending his army into battle. He's outnumbered 10 to 1 to start with. And then he says, okay, but you can't go out and kill, you can't go kill their leader if you had the opportunity. You got to deal gently with him. So that's probably a little frustrating in terms of Joab, Abishai, and maybe Ittai. But that was the standing order. Now, who is the king? David. Who are the military commanders? That's those guys we just talked about. Who should be obeying the orders of the king if they were the true soldier? Those three guys, right? Okay, so remember that. Their orders are not to do harm to Absalom. Okay, so now we're getting set up here for the battle. We'll go back to the map here. We'll see that Absalom now moves his army up. He moves northward out of Gilead, up and crosses the river Jabbok, and then turns east towards the forest of Ephraim. Now, when you kind of think about what's going on here, and some of the commentaries based on some of the historical writings, say of Josephus and some of the other historians, that Absalom was probably making this move upward, turning westward there on the other side of Mahanaim, where he knew that David was camped and set up here. And the speculation is that he was planning a pitched battle with David somewhere in this area right in here, and for some reason he didn't think anybody knew he was coming. He had his army probably in some kind of mode where they were conveying their equipment and their supplies and so forth. He's out. They didn't have lookouts apparently posted. They didn't have scouts out. They thought they were as big as they were. Nobody was going to mess with them. They were going to plan this battle, and they were just going to annihilate David and his army. Well, David had other plans, obviously. With the three different divisions that he had, he attacked Absalom's army. Again, some of the speculation was that most of their weapons were still stored in wagons and carts and so forth, moving them up before they actually issued them out to the soldiers and so forth before they went into battle. Some of the lighter weapons, a sword, a spear, a shield, probably were carried by those soldiers. But at the same time, a lot of their stuff could very well have been in the wagons and carts. Surprise attack by David, by David's army in three different fronts, as we'd say today. Those three divisions attacked, and they attacked with very experienced and battle-hardened troops. A lot of the troops that Absalom had, even though 40,000 of them, were a lot of, as we'd say today, reserve units or civilian soldiers, folks that volunteered to fight all over the kingdom. And the experienced soldiers, as the text uses the word slaughter, they killed them. They killed Absalom's soldiers to the point of where half the army, 20,000 of them, were killed. Now, if you think about from historical point of views and that kind of thing, and just from a personal point of view, if you were in an army that you thought in your mind was going to be so victorious, you just went out, you just walked down the street walked across the field, wherever you were marching to, with your head held up, boy, we're just going to go win this thing. We're just going to go take it away from David. And all of a sudden, from here, from here, from here comes three battle groups attacking you and killing soldiers. What's the worst thing that can happen in an army that's being attacked? Panic. Panic set into Absalom's army, didn't it? Well, when panic sets in, then the order dissolves and chaos sets in. And then it comes down to what's on the soldier's mind then. Every man for himself, right? Okay, so it's also interesting that I forgot the verse number. Let's see, I got it written down here. Verse 8 says that the forest, or some translation talks about the woods. Remember that this battle is raging. This battle is raging up in around this area called the Forest of Ephraim. And apparently it got scattered out after the initial attacks and panic set in. There were skirmishes all over this forest. Now this forest, in verse 8 it says that the forest itself, the forest devoured more people than the sword devoured. Now that means that apparently that there were as many killed in this Forest of Ephraim as there was outside in the open battle. And how would a forest be able to kill somebody? And again, I can't even come up with a good one on this one, because most of the commentators said, we don't know. We don't know how to interpret this verse. So the speculation is that it probably means something to the effect that it was a very rugged countryside within the forest, and in that general area around that forest, there were a lot of crevices. There was a lot of wild animals in that area, in that forest. So men that were wounded in battle could have crawled into that forest, would have dehydrated and died, would have died from hunger, from their wounds. They may have been attacked by animals and so forth. Yes, sir. I'm sorry?
It's probably very treacherous to be in that forest.
Oh, absolutely.
Have you seen some forests are so thick that you can't see for all the trees?
You can't see the forest, right? Well, and I think you're absolutely right, because the forest was a treacherous area, and we're going to see that it turns out to be very treacherous for Absalom here in just a few minutes, aren't we? So you're right. So the forest itself turned out to be maybe an ally for David's troops and so forth. But be that as it may, now then we've got when the Bible, when we see the words written, and the men went back to their own house. When the army starts going home, the commanders hadn't got much left, have they? So we see that's happening now in terms of Absalom's army. He has pretty much, he's physically killed, looks like about half the army, and the rest of them in their panic and so forth has decided, I'm going to get back on the other side of the River Jordan and get to my house, and nobody will know I've been over there maybe. But anyway, that's where we stand there. Now, somewhere in this whole event, Absalom is riding under a tree on his mule, and he gets his head caught in some of the branches of this tree. Now, that kind of adds to the comment we just made in terms of the treacherousness of this forest. I mean, it was so thick and so forth that he got his head caught in a low-hanging limb or something. I'm a big fan of the Western movies that were very popular when I was a kid. And inevitably, it seemed like when there was a chase scene, when the Cisco Kid or Gene Autry or Roy or any of the other good guys was chasing the bad guy and they went under a tree, what happened? Bad guy caught it right there, didn't he? And that's what I, this time though, instead of being knocked off of his mule, Absalom hung his head in the limb and the mule kept right on going. He's just hanging there now. My grandfather had a mare that he kept when his two oldest sons, he bought a pair of horses, a mare for one of them and a big stallion for the other guy. Well, the stallion turned out to be too much to handle, so they got rid of him. But the mare, my grandfather held on to him, and even though he had a tractor and all this stuff, he always used that mare to pull a plow and do his garden with it. He always did the garden with her. Well, those two older brothers had two younger brothers that were in the same neighborhood as age-wise as I was, or I am, because we're all around. But anyway, and those two younger ones were always getting me in trouble. But separate and apart from that, I was riding a horse one day, and they said, just ride her and just give her a rein, she'll go to the barn. Well, what they didn't tell me was that every time they'd go to the barn with that mare, they'd reach up and grab a hold of the loft and swing off the horse, and she headed to the back to get fed. Well, I go riding her in there. She turns right into the hallway of the barn. I go, this is all right. And all of a sudden, I realize I'm like the bad guys being chased by Roy Rogers. I'm fixing to get decapitated by the loft here. And finally, I just roll off and get my clothes dirty and this kind of stuff. And, of course, I'm in trouble now with my mom. But so I think about that story every time I think about Absalom hanging there with his head caught in those limbs. And when he's hanging there, and one of David's soldiers sees him. Now, what would be the reaction normally for an opposing soldier to find the leader of the opposing army? What would you do if he was kind of incapacitated? You would make him even more incapacitated, wouldn't you? You would incapacitate him even more. But what did this soldier do? He left, didn't do a thing to Absalom. Absalom's hanging here by his head now. And he goes and reports to Joab. He finds Joab and he reports to him, I saw Absalom hanging in the tree. And at this point in time, I keep having doubts about Joab, because he does things that really throws you off. He will be, at some point in time, he's most loyal, dedicated to David. And then he turns around like that, tries to deceive him by getting Absalom back. Okay, maybe that was for love or whatever. But he does other things. But this soldier reports to Joab and says, Absalom is incapacitated. He's hanging on this tree. And Joab, instead of saying, thank you, I appreciate that information, just as we would say, he chews him out, doesn't he? I would have paid you 10 silver pieces if you'd come and told me you killed him. And I mean to tell you, in today's terms, he really got to get onto this guy's case about not being, you can imagine what the conversation may have sounded like in addition to what we have recorded there in the text. But you just really messed up here. And it's at the end of the thing, he says, I don't have time to listen to this. Or I don't want to fool with this, basically. But somewhere in that conversation, that soldier says a couple of things that leads us again to wonder a little bit about Joab. He said, he reminds Joab, what did the king say about Absalom? Don't you kill him. Remember, show mercy, be kind, do not kill Absalom. And you, if I would have killed him, Joab, then you could have stepped back and said, look at this guy. He disobeyed the order, and you wouldn't have defended me. Now, that leads me to believe that that guy didn't trust Joab totally. And if soldiers don't trust their commander, then we got a bad situation going here. This guy knew enough about Joab maybe to understand that Joab would have been in a perfect position to play both sides against the middle on that one. He could have gotten Absalom killed and could have stepped back and said, no, it wasn't me. I didn't order that. And that's what that guy reminds him of. So this soldier was one, pretty astute. Number two, definitely loyal to David because he followed the order. So then that's when Joab says, I don't have, as we'd say today, I don't have time for this. Yes, sir.
Joab, one of the most dangerous men you could ever meet, double-minded.
So Joab, could, again, there's even speculation that maybe Joab was still wanting to overthrow everybody and him and make himself the king. As you read all this, we don't know. A lot of that's just all that speculation, of course. But as you read through that, you could kind of see where some of these military leaders, and we see it today, where who's the biggest threat to a sitting president or a sitting ruler of any kingdom? It's their military commanders, aren't they? So now Joab says, okay, I don't have time to argue with you about this anymore. So he goes, finds Absalom, pierces him then with 3 darts, and then has 10 of his young men that are his armor bearers. They then commence to strike Absalom and kill him. So now then, wannabe King Absalom has been killed in battle. His army is in total disarray. Most of them are fleeing back across the Jordan River to their homes. Are those that lived on the west side of the Jordan. They're fleeing back. And so now then we have the fighting has ended. Joab recalls the troops. And he restrains the troops from pursuing the other army or the other members of surviving members of Absalom's army. Joab not only recalls them, but he issues the order to not pursue them. Now, there's some indication here, and as we go forward, that even though Joab was a commander of one of the 3 divisions, that he might have been more like a supreme commander of the entire operation, as well as commanding one of the 3 divisions also. But he very unceremoniously took Absalom's body and threw it in a pit and covered it with rocks. So he's buried Absalom. Absalom gets a very undignified, if you will, non-dignified, non-ceremonial burial. And not a whole lot to remember him by. So that was his reward for what he had done. So we've taken a young man who was sticking up for his sister several weeks ago, who's now decided he wanted to take the kingdom away from his father, and God has punished him for that and cost him his life. Now then, this guy, and it talks about Ahimus, was one of the son of one of the prophets back in, not prophets, one of the priests back in Jerusalem. It was part of the spy network that David had set up. We talked about him last week. He's one of the ones that hid in the well and this kind of stuff. He's very loyal to David, obviously. He wants to get back to Manahem and tell David the news. Man, we have destroyed Absalom's army, and Absalom is dead. Joab says, no, you're not going to go back. I'm not going to send you back to David with that news. He then turns to what's called, in the text, I believe it says, he sends a Cushite, which from some of the reading I did says that was probably an Ethiopian slave that was there that was with Joab. He sends the Cushite. He said, you go take the message back to King David. Well, and he leaves to tell the news. Ahimus then says, no matter what you say, yeah, I'm not, basically, you can kind of hear that. He convinces Joab to let him go. He may have put it in terms of, I'm going anyway, but I want your permission to go. So behind the Cushite, Ahimaaz starts on his journey back to the city of Menahem to share this news with David. And it's interesting that Ahimaaz must have been a little more energetic about doing it than the Cushite was. He didn't seem to be in any hurry. So Ahimaaz passes him and gets to the city first. Now, I want to stop there because we'll pick up here next week, but I want to ask you this. Why would Joab not want Ahimaaz to carry that news back to David? Okay, he might have thought that he was the one to kill Absalom. Have you ever heard that message about shoot the messenger? I think here, in this case, because you got to go back to when the news was brought to David about King Saul's death, a couple of occasions, David didn't react real well to that. Now, a couple of times, some of the messengers were being treacherous about it, but at the same time, I think maybe Joab was being a little protective of Ahimaaz here. You really don't want, let me send a slave so if something bad happens to him, if David overreacts, so to speak, that'll happen to him, not to you. But it turns out Ahimaaz goes on, and we'll pick up there next week with David's reaction to the news of the victory and so forth. Thank you so much.